Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series. This event was proudly supported by ARA Group.
Good morning, Melbourne. This is just fucking fabulous. Thank you, everyone, on coming on this beautiful Saturday morning to talk about books. What could be more soul-fortifying than that? Can I please say that as we share our stories today, let us acknowledge the story of this place. We meet today on the lands of the Kulin Nations, the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. We pay respect to their elders past and present, to the elders of all communities and cultures across Victoria. May we endeavour to cherish and protect the stories of those who have come before us, to hear their beauty, to heed their lessons. My name is BJ Silcox, and I'm absolutely not the person you came to see. I'm a book critic, and my job is to introduce these two magnificent women, but you actually don't really need me to do that. This is Helen, this is Chloe. They're fucking fabulous. Buy their books. That's my job done. What can I tell you that's not in the program or on Wikipedia? Late minute revelation, Helen Garner has never tried chicken salt. I'm pretty shocked by this. If someone can remedy it, that would be great. In the lead up to today's event, I've had conversations about serial killers, fake art, shitting in Harrods bags, the fate of war dogs, neoliberal career terror, and the many unholy things that people have done with pumpkins. So you're in for a treat. The theme of the festival this year is ambition. It's a loaded word, particularly for women, a shorthand for a particular kind of ruthlessness. Sharp elbows, greedy hearts, bad mothers, the deliberately barren. It's a loaded word for books too. It's the kind of word that critics like me deploy when books are long on words and very short on merit. But it's a word worth rescuing from sexism and faint praise and tall poppy sneering, because I want to read ambitious books. Books full of ideas and wanting, books that are weird and strange and vulnerable and strident and unafraid to fail, books that demand, that command an opinion. I'm so tired of praising Australian books for being unapologetically smart, like it's somehow courageous to think. I want books that show us our worst selves and demand that we do better, and show us our best selves and kindle hope. I want, in short, the kind of books that these two women write. Their work seeks answers to dark and difficult questions, to impossible questions, to necessary questions, and that's a deeply generous ambition. And that's why we're here today on this Saturday morning, hiding out in the dark together, because of that generosity. Helen and Chloe have new books out, and they're the most generous books they've ever written to date. With the final volume of her diaries, How to End a Story, Helen Garner completes one of the most audacious projects in contemporary Australian literature, an exercise in radical exposure. It's as riveting as a novel, and it's the tale of a writer yearning for a room of her own. In Chloe Hooper's new book, her first volume of memoir, she stares down death. When Chloe's partner was diagnosed with a rare form of leukemia, she went in search of a book. If she could just find the right words, she thought, she could forearm her young sons, offer them an incantation against the dark. Bedtime Story is the book she wrote because she couldn't find that book. It's a quest, a reader's quest for guidance, a mother's quest for solace, a writer's quest for precision. A question beats at the heart of both of these books. What can a story do? Let's find out. Please join me in welcoming Chloe Hooper and Helen Garner.
I feel like we're at a revivalist meeting.
I can totally...
Ambition!
Ambition! Well, it sort of feels disingenuous. We're all very inversions of black, although this is Melbourne, but the Queen's dead. It feels a bit... Well, she is. It feels a little bit strange not to sort of engage with that idea before we start, because it's sort of momentous. How did it feel to you when the Queen died? Do we have any thoughts on...
Yeah, me, sad. I was really sad. And I've thought about it a bit, and I think it's because she's always been there right through my childhood. And I look back on... I remember the first thing I remembered was when the King died, her father, and that was in, what, 52, I think. Anyway, me and my sister were lying in bed in our bedroom, and Dad came in breakfast time with the paper in his hand. And he stood at the door, and my father was not this kind of person at all. He was like really sort of casual. He stood at the door and he said, "The King is dead." And we were both, you know, in our little beds. And then he just walked back out of the room and went back. And I thought of that today, and it sort of really touched me. And I remembered how when she was crowned, that all the magazines, the colour magazines, had these fabulous photos of the crown jewels, you know, close-ups of the crown and these emeralds as big as a fist, and we cut them out and stuck them on our bedroom walls with sticky tape. And she's been a huge presence, and not some that you not one that you actually thought about much, but I felt very sad and kind of shocked, because I mean, obviously that's ridiculous to be shocked because she was so old. She's so old and frail. But yeah,
it reminded me of that. I lived in Egypt for a few years, and there's a pharaoh called, you know, Great Ramesses, Ramesses the Great, who lived into his 90s at a time when the average life expectancy was, you know, 30 years. And so for three generations, he was alive for people, always alive for people. And he had, of course, proclaimed himself a god. And as far as they were concerned, he was, because he was immortal. He had never died. And there's a sense of the death of some kind of god. And gods can be cruel and apathetic and crap and also comforting and offer all of those things to us. But there's some sense that one of the gods has died, and with it comes a possibility and an emptiness and a strange existential grief. Chloe, your son had a particular take on it.
Yes. Well, Don came out and did what your father did to our son, who was eating his porridge, and said, "The Queen is dead." And our 10-year-old just looked up and said, "I think Charles killed her."
What sort of a family is yours?
Yeah, this is our family.
Yeah.
But I think there is a sort of moment that we are spinning out into chaos with wars and floods and fires and, there's this sort of cultural feeling of that everyone suddenly feels like they've been orphaned or something because she was a sort of appeared, appeared to kind of represent stability or something for some people. But there's also, you know, the possibility of an exciting conversation about what Australia, might now look like. Too soon to...
No, I broke out my party shoes.
Yeah.
Does asking if you're ambitious feel like a gotcha question?
Me? No. I don't. I mean, because I grew up in a sort of... I feel like I grew up in a quite conservative milieu where, for a girl to be ambitious was, you know, it was sort of like you had a drop of Lady Macbeth's blood. But it's just a word, isn't it, about, how can you think about story in a way that is expansive and about the minute detail and the sort of, zooming out the bigger detail. And, you could just talk about vocation, you can talk about, in our day it was just you sort of hoped and dreamed to be a writer. But I also think it's not as though ambition is kind of some sort of secret sauce. It takes as much, a really bad writer can be as ambitious about their work as a really, you know, great writer. So I don't take it personally.
Have you been accused of ambition, Helen?
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, it was a sort of a dirty word back in the 70s when we were all hippies. You know, you were supposed to kind of go with the flow and not have any personal drives, I suppose. But I've always thought that I've always excused myself from a personal accusation of ambition by thinking, well, you know, I never cared if my books got published overseas or not. I wasn't writing for that. I knew that I never was writing for that. And I wanted to write for here, and I wanted to be able to say things with ease that I knew that my readers would immediately understand and I wouldn't have to sort of laboriously explain. But when I look back now, I think, yes, I was ambitious in the sense that I wanted to do this work and I wanted to... I see what sacrifices other people made or that I forced upon them. And I suppose that makes me get a creepy feeling. I still feel a bit... You know, women, we're not supposed to be ambitious, and as you said, and especially, you know, in my generation, that you were supposed to, like, you know, let's not go through all that old feminist stuff again, but...
Well, there's a story in one of your diaries that really sticks with me about the way your ambition grates up against what you're expected to want. And I wonder if you might tell it to us. You know, you've published the first stone.
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
Yeah.
Now, well, after I published the first stone, and I got into a lot of trouble, but the thing about the first stone was that it sold like a huge amount of copies really fast, and I was completely bewildered, and I knew it was going to sell some copies, but, you know, it was really quite shocking and I didn't know what to do with it. Anyway... And I was being attacked on all sides by feminists who agreed with my sort of feminism. Anyway, one day I get a call from the secretary of the editor of the Australian newspaper, and she says, oh, the editor would like to see you. In other words, I was like summoned. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, where do you get off? Anyway, I thought, well, you know, I was just curious, and I thought, what could this be about? So I went in and... He was kind of lolling behind his desk in a luxurious way, and he said...
Did he have his feet up on the desk?
Pretty much, yeah. But, no, he said... and I was just kind of sitting nervously, and he said, well... he basically offered me work. He said, we'd like you to work for us, and we'd want you to do X number of pieces a year, and this is what we'll pay you. And he said, you know, and after a while, who knows, you might eventually get to... interview the Prime Minister. And I thought, is there anything in my work, I thought but didn't say this, is there anything in my work that make you think I would be interested in interviewing the Prime Minister? And then I thought, oh, you idiot, he hasn't read your work. He hasn't read a word of your work. He doesn't know what you're interested in. All he knows is that you've sold a book that sold a lot of copies. And so that was kind of squashing. And I said, oh, thanks very much. Oh, I'll think about it. And I went away and I didn't think about it. And I but I was kind of insulted, you know, in some way, that he really thought that I was going, God, one day I really want to interview the Prime Minister. And what... Is that an ambition, even?
It is. It's not a very good one. But I think that's really telling about the kind of work you're doing, that there's something... Your ambitions are ordinary in a... And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. You've written about ordinary things. Why is the ordinary radical?
Well, why isn't the ordinary ambitious?
Yeah.
Another way of putting it. Yeah, well, I mean, if I'm ambitious, I'm ambitious to get it right, you know, to do it well, just to do... Because, you know, in my generation, we were called... our books were called small canvas books.
Well, I think that it, you know, isn't that in a way what you're getting to, is that the ordinary is female.
Yeah.
And so if it's domestic, it's... Small canvas.
Yeah. Domestic things are... Yeah, you should be out there. I'm not quite sure what you were supposed to be writing about.
The Prime Minister.
Yeah. But, yeah. And war and stuff like that.
Your Prime Minister in war, great deeds of great men.
Great deeds.
Mm. Chloe, Bedtime Stories is an elegy, in a sense, to the ordinary. Really spends time looking at it. And you've written about arson and mass murder and colonial violence, but somehow this seems...
I have interviewed the Prime Minister.
Oh! Yeah, yeah.
And I've interviewed Julia Gillard. So, yeah.
Did you say, and I've interviewed Julia Gillard? Or is she the Prime Minister you
interviewed? She was the Prime
Okay,
Minister.
Okay, cool. Yeah. That's the coolest one.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
Why does writing about ordinary life, so writing about the kids doing their teeth at night and writing and reading bedtime stories to your kids, why is that seemingly the most risky thing you've ever done?
Well, I didn't think it was. I mean, like Helen, I think you sort of, you know, I will write about what's in front of me, and if the canvas shrinks and it's your home life, which was in that period, that's what I'll sort of take out my notebook and start investigating. But I guess that, you know, well, I mean, the lessons are from Helen's work about it might seem very small, and yet actually if you extrapolate it out, you've got the history of children's literature and, you know, how adults and children think about mortality. And I guess, you know, children's stories are, in a way, a kind of that's where we put the source code for what is most important to us as a society, because we always want to sort of embed in these stories, you know, what's most important to us for those who are often most important to us. So, you know, I guess I would just sort of, you know, fight anyone, come up on the stage and I'll fight you about, you know, this being small.
Yeah. I got to review Chloe's book and I had a very visceral response to the idea of reviewing it. And I actually said to my editor, I don't think I should review it. I'm not a parent. And she turned around and said, nonsense. All you need to review this book is empathy. You have empathy. You're reviewing this book. And I read it and I was trying to work out, because I love Chloe's work. I inhale Chloe's work. Why had I had such a strong and visceral reaction to not wanting to write it? And I realized as I read it, it was because I wasn't reading it as an adult. I was reading it as a kid. And I was a kid who lost a number of people who meant very much to me at the age that Chloe's writing and talking to her kids. And the memories that those stories unlocked, that book unlocked, were extraordinary and terrifying and beautiful. But I had that protective child instinct of, like, this is somehow going to access it, and it did. And I think that's what's so radical about your book, is you are getting to that source code. You're getting right back to the point at which we hand our children the inheritance of storytelling. Chloe, you write in Bedtime Stories, just as wizards, by naming things precisely, can control them. A writer who can find the right set of words for what grieves them can pin the grievance down, fixing it in place. Language is a trap we build to catch meaning. When I think of both of you, I think of you as our best trap makers, our most precise writers. What does the right set of words feel like? How do you know when you've set the trap right?
Helen?
Well, you get this floating feeling and...
No, it's...
Really? Because I feel it's like a sort of electric...
I don't know. You slog away for weeks and months at a time, and it's all dead on the page. And then one day you come in, and you know, because it's, I don't know. I think it's true of all writers. You know, we sort of hate ourselves in a long term way, and there's just this slog of it. You know, just it's very tiring and disheartening, and it's easy to believe your own self hatred and think that it's real.
But I think also a really good book can often be a really bad book right until the last minute. So
when you're working on it,
yeah.
Well, I was slogging towards something. Thank you. You just saved me 5 minutes of waffle.
That was just a trap I casually feel.
Consider yourself caught.
No, it's true. You get to the end and you suddenly go, and you think, oh, God, I've got another bloody 50 pages to write. And then you come in the next morning, you look at the last bit, and you think, hey, that's it. That's the end. It's finished. Mm. You don't even know what you're doing a lot of the time. You're just slogging blindly onwards. I read somewhere in Nadine Gordimer, there's a terrific introduction to her collection of short stories, and she said, writers don't even know when they're working. They don't even know, because you're walking around, looking at things, listening to what people say, and there's something in there that's kind of registering it and storing it, and you don't even know that's happening a lot of the time. And then when you sit down, this is when I think I'm onto something, when I sit down and I'm laboriously creating something, and then something pops up that I remember, or something actual that really happened, or something somebody said to me, I go, oh yeah, pop, and I'll just pop that in there, and it just goes sparkle, sparkle, and it just, that's when I know I'm onto something, when what I didn't know I knew comes back in little stabs and flashes.
There are a few things I take from what you've said, which I recognise, you know, the whole lot, but A, that if I think writers are kind of always working, and that is quite exhausting, kind of carrying the work around with you, you know, throughout the day, and that is a sacrifice to the family, I think, because, yeah, you know, you're sometimes, available. you know, really not as present as it would be nice to be. The other thing is, you know, the coming in the next day and finding something there, that's really rich, those moments in the morning when you're not yet, when you actually can see what you're doing kind of clearly.
Mm. Yeah.
But also just sort of searching for, you know, that you've, you know, built the right trap when you're not bored by what's on the page,
yeah,
when you suddenly find there's a moment of heat and light there.
Yeah, and you don't exactly, I think the boring parts are when you sort of know what you're saying, and when you stop knowing what you're doing and you kind of, and you stop being bored and you get that little scared feeling, but you think, I'll keep going, I'll just follow that, I'll follow that.
Yeah. Well, there's a chemical reaction between two things.
Yeah.
What strikes me as perhaps a sort of anti-answer to this question is a thing that you both don't do, and you don't use easy cop-outs. And a really great example of that is that you reject sort of large judgmental labels like monstrous and evil. So you've both written books about monstrous acts. You've written about arson, mass murder. You've written about a father who drove his children into a lake. You've written about quite extraordinary colonial violence, but you don't talk about the perpetrators as monsters. You very much interrogate what they are. I'd love you to talk about that suspended sense of judgment and what we lose when we use big terms like that.
Mm. Well, I could talk about that because when I wrote that book about Robert Farquharson in that book called This House of Grief, there were people, women who'd said, not to me, but this been reported to me by someone else, oh, I'm not going to read that book of Helen's. Oh, yeah, why is that? Because nowhere in this book, people have this confidence of saying this about a book they haven't read, but nowhere in this book does she say that Robert Farquharson is a monster. And, you know, first of all, I was quite shocked by that, and I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, if he was a monster, I wouldn't have been interested in writing a book about him. I think that's... I'm not interested in, for example, serial killers. There are some people that I, you know, read about them in the paper, and my gut reaction is that person should be executed immediately because, you know, they've killed 23 people and they're obviously not wanting to stop. It's hard to think of them as a person. Whereas somebody who, this is something that I always find if I go to a court and, you know, you expect to see the person in the dock looking like a beast, you know, if somebody who's accused of killing their children or whatever their horrible crime, what they're alleged to have committed, and you expect to see someone really scary and horrible, but mostly what you see is someone broken, someone who's done something so terrible that they've destroyed themselves as well, and they've gone through that sort of membrane that most of us have between us and our absolutely darkest and most brutal instincts, which we all have, I maintain. But most of us don't go there. Something saves us from it. But what you see when you go into the court and see the person in the dock is you see the person who's gone through that membrane or gone through that floor that most of us have. And that's, to say a monster to me is denying that person's similarity to me. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. It makes them other and that makes it easy.
Yeah. So it's easy to say, oh, what a monster, off with his head. Well, that's easy, and you don't have to sit there and think, and you don't have to go into the darkest parts of yourself where horrible fantasies and dreams reside.
Or think about the culture that made him, which is very much what you do in The Arsonist, Chloe, is.
Yes, but it's interesting. I mean, I don't want to sort of make this into a therapy session here. But,
why not?
But here we are.
You can lie down if you want.
All right, yeah, just like a Jason recliner goes back. Well, it's interesting to me hearing Helen talking about a person who's gone through the membrane, because that's what you've done, Helen. You've gone through the you've passed into this other sphere where you... And maybe to some extent I have too, where there is a kind of, you know, you've accepted the monstrosity of ambition, and you're prepared to actually look at these things and then do this sort of thing that a nice girl wasn't meant to do and write about them as well. And so perhaps the sort of, you said before that writers kind of don't like it themselves. There's a freedom in, you know, accepting... You know, well, there's something.
Your own monstrousness.
Yeah, your own monstrousness, and then turning up and, you know, with those unrosy glasses, sort of looking at a situation and writing about it. Anyway, did any of that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, here we are. Absolutely.
And I also think one of the things you both do is use a willingness to stare at cruelty as a mirror, not just for yourselves, but for us. Asking us to stand in front of it and look at what we see when we use it as a kind of point of reflection and cultural refraction. And I think that's one of the things that your books do by not engaging with those sort of lazy throw-offs, as you say, like, these people were made, and that's a story we all share. That's a culpability that we all share.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You've also both stared death in the eye. In your book particularly, Chloe, you sort of chase it across the pages of literature from Indigenous sort of storytelling all the way through to The Very Hungry Caterpillar. And what do we see when we do that?
It's really... I've just remembered something that... I have to share this story with you. A bookseller who I really love. I mentioned that I, you know, a couple of years ago that I was writing... about this subject or in Bedtime Story, and about Don's illness and looking at ways of talking about this with my children. And she turned to me really earnestly and said, if you write about death, what are you going to say to all of those people who say you're just copying Helen Garner?
What?
I was like... Wow, now Helen has even cornered the, you know, this subject. Where do I go now?
As
death,
if
trademark.
I'm the first Australian who ever wrote a book about death. Hello.
But, yeah.
It didn't exist. You invented it, apparently.
Yeah, it's all my fault.
Where were we?
Yeah. In a sense, what do we see when we look it in the face? Like, why is it necessary to...
Oh, well, I mean, I think that for children and for adults, I mean, you know, very basically, if you can talk to them about about death, you can also talk about life and how do we want to live our best life.
Yes.
And I suppose, you know, if you also, you know, write a book which describes darkness, I mean, maybe there's, you know, that is actually a way of highlighting how we might better treat people and how we might better operate as a society.
Mm. Yeah. Helen, you've talked about the beauty of the coronial system of being...
Oh, I was just thinking about that, actually. I was thinking when I don't know, I wanted to see a dead body and I'd never seen one. Mm. And I figured, I mean, this all sounds
here
like...
Here it goes back to, you know, I think Charles Kilder.
Yeah. Yeah. But I thought, and I heard they had a new, this is way back in the early 90s, I heard there was a new forensic department that had just been built down there behind the Arts Centre, and I thought, oh, I wonder if I could get in there and have a look and see what they do down there. So I can't remember how I did this. I think I'll ring up the coroner or something. And, this was before I did any of those crime books about crimes. But I don't know, somehow I got enabled or permitted to go down to this new place and I just rocked up and I didn't know what I was going to say at the door, and I can't remember what I said, but I was, you know, they were just welcoming to me and they said, oh, would you like to watch an autopsy? I go, yes, please. And so but what they did was there was a kind of like a lab, you know, a room where they do the autopsy, and there was like a little kind of mezzanine section where people could watch, and up there, there was me, and there was a couple of blokes in suits, and I didn't know who they were. And so we watched, you sort of looked down about as far as I am from the front row here and watched the technicians just basically take a body apart. And it was the most extraordinary thing I ever saw in my life or that I had seen up to date. And it was very quiet and thoughtful and sort of beautiful in some way. Anyway, so I went home, you know, kind of completely bowled over and not knowing what I was going to like do with what I'd seen. And the next day the coroner rings me up.
Yeah.
And no, wait, let me get this straight. The Age, who I had thought of doing an article for about this, called me up and said, oh, listen, the coroner's on the phone, he's furious. What have I done? And so she said, you've got to ring the coroner. So I ring the coroner and he was in a towering rage and said, how did you get in to see an autopsy? He said, there were detectives present. And I don't know why that made it so particularly outrageous, but I said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Hallenstein. I thought it was okay. You know, they said I could come in. And he said, well, I'll tell you what you're going to do. He said, you're going to put on technician's clothes and you're going to come down here and you're going to spend a whole day watching an autopsy with a technician telling you what's happening. You know, he said, as if this was a punishment. And I'm going, yay! So I'm going, yes, Mr. Hallenstein, I'll be there at 9 o'clock. So I rocked up and I just spent the next 3 days hanging out at the morgue. And it was, I just loved it. I can't tell you how much I remember I'd arrive in the morning and the pathologists would be already at work, you know, each one neatly cutting up a corpse. And they'd say, oh, hi, Helen. And they'd kind of get on with their work. And I'd say, oh, hi, Kylie. Hi, so, and I'd say hello and I'd go and stand next to them and watch. And well, I got home one day from doing this and I said to my sister, oh, gee, I really love it. You know, I go in there and we all say good morning. And she said, Helen, what you need is a job. But the funny thing was about it, I really loved the way the people who worked there were so, you know, old journalists, you know, real old drunken old journalists, blokes that I used to meet at the pub back in the 70s, they used to tell these stories about the morgue that were like Dickensian horror shows, you know, like, you know, babies thrown and this is where blood everywhere and corpses and people, you know, sexual things happening. And I thought it was so... I wasn't really expecting that because I knew they were full of shit, those guys. But but there was something so kind of calm and patient about these people, and they were unshockable. And I interviewed some of them, and they were sort of they said to me things like this. Well, of course, we're not dealing with death. Death's already been and gone by the time we start our work. But they also said, I said, well, who do you socialise with? And they laughed and said, cops and nurses. And that was, so that's like they've gone through that membrane. Mm. And they're most at ease with other people who've gone through it as well and who can be in the presence of dead bodies and...
You didn't think of becoming a pathologist?
No, I'm not very scientific. No, and people, when I go to the courts, people say, did you ever think of becoming a lawyer? No.
Well, speaking of jobs, when was the first time you wrote writer on a passport or a form? When did you first feel like you earned it?
Look, I think I, you know, was a 20-year-old. I mean, I'm sure I thought, you know, I'm a writer. And what, you know, well, I think that it's an ongoing process becoming a good writer. And I think that goes on and on. And perhaps the time, that, you know, when I first naively wrote that, when I was published quite young, I would have written that, but and I've subsequently earned it.
You have earned it, girlfriend.
You have absolutely earned it.
Well, thank you.
You could even write, good writer, now. Yeah.
I'll consider that.
Yeah. I don't know if they allow adjectives on passport forms.
Well, hey, kick-ass writer.
Good.
Yeah. Okay. Helen, when was the first time you felt like you could say it?
Oh, I reckon I'd probably published a couple of books before I felt that. But I, I remember once when I arrived back in Australia from some other place, and I think it was in Brisbane. Is it possible to they have international flights to Brisbane? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I rock up at the passport check, and the guy looks at my passport and he looks at me, and I thought, oh my God, is there something wrong? I said, is something wrong? And he says, no. He says, I've never met a writer before. I just didn't know what they looked like.
Helen, you told me a story recently, which was that you'd gone into a shop and someone had been really thrilled to see you, and then said, I've just got to say that Hotel Sorrento is my favourite. And in terms of literary celebrity, I have a story of recently sitting at a kind of kids' sports event, and I always sort of dread people asking, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a writer. Have you read anything I would have written? Oh, probably not, but my last book was called The Arsonist. And this woman was like, wait till I tell the kids. They saw The Arsonist on the bedside table, arsonist. And we had to go through this for sort of, you know, like 5 minutes. And it was just like, yep. There we are. There's literary celebrity in Australia.
You're the woman who wrote that ass book.
Yeah.
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 So both
ambition.
Of you, yeah, that's right. I got the word wank into The Guardian this week and I was so pleased with myself. Yeah. You've both drawn on diaries for your most recent books, or sort of, in your case, Chloe, sort of almost a running diary.
Yeah.
For yours... it has the sort of immediacy of capturing a moment and then moving on for it. Helen, for you, you're looking back at diaries. Are either of you surprised by the woman you find in those pages?
By the what?
By the person you find there, the woman you find there. We'll start with you, Chloe. Does she feel like you, or have you managed to capture something and move away from her?
Well, I think it's probably different because, I mean, mine, they're not really diary entries so much as, not, you know, I'm an... a note taker, but notes on the back of an envelope and, you know, on a receipt or a letter, and then I kind of put them together quite, you know, quite quickly to make this book, which I think is different from Helen's astonishing project of going back over, you know, periods of a life. In terms of finding, you know, revisiting yourself, it wasn't a sort of.
Yours is a kind of urgent capturing, almost like a time capsule moment.
Yeah.
But the person you've captured in there, does she feel like you or a character?
Oh. Well, I mean, I guess it's a sort of a side of me. And I don't in a way feel like I'm sort of the you know, at the front of this sort of family portrait. But there, it is interesting whenever you storyize your own life, because mm-hmm. There are moments where you can kind of, you know, turning yourself into a character, it does have strange, you know, consequences, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You're very aware of where that sort of, is this still true?
Yeah.
Okay, can we move on from me now?
But no, it's interesting that idea that of the narrator as character.
Yeah.
Because you can't, because you have to make such a lot of decisions when you're writing, when there's an I narrator. And obviously that person's whole life isn't there. And especially in a book like your one, which is focused on a very particular question and a huge question, the question of impending death and grief and loss. But so in a sense you're using the bits of yourself that are useful to tell that story or to get that information into an accessible form.
Yes, but it's when you're moving yourself around on the page as a character, then you've got to be very careful that you're not sort of, you know, making yourself do
putting
something.
Yourself.
Well, no, actually, just cheating, because you know there are, you want the kind of, you know, in fiction you can make a character do something which you you know you might not have in that moment in a book done anything heroic or interesting at all. So you can't then fake it.
Yeah.
Suddenly I'm like, there are lots of people listening to us talking here.
No, there's no one out there. Just a whole lot of white masks.
Say something with some heat and light now.
Were you surprised by the woman you found in the diary?
Yeah, I was horrified. I thought... I thought, what a fucking wimp. That was the thing that amazed me the most about that third book with the diaries, not the earlier one so much, but... you know, on every other page I'm going, and you call yourself a feminist? That kind of feeling. But... No, I was shocked by how I kind of lay back and took it. You know, I allowed somebody to steamroll me, and my resistance, it seemed to me, was feeble, and I was shocked again and again and again in looking at the diaries themselves, and I had to make a decision. I thought, well. There's no point doing this if I take out all the bits where I look pathetic. You know, that's the thing. Yeah. If you are working on something where you appear, you don't want to appear as a wimp. But if I didn't appear as a wimp or as whatever it is that I was, there's no point in telling the story, you know, because otherwise it would just be a hatchet job. And I didn't want that book to be a hatchet job. I wanted it to be a depiction of a relationship, and I think that must have worked because of the number of women who have said to me since that book came out, this could be my marriage, and that really shocked me.
But that's also the sort of bravery and the sort of mightiness of publishing this, that you tell this much, much bigger story through the seeming minutiae again.
Yeah, but what a relief. I mean, you see, when people say that to me, I just want to cast myself on their shoulder and bawl. I think, look, I'm so sorry that you're going through this, but thank God it's not just me. You know, that's the thing I've found with the diaries all along, is that people still talk sometimes as if keeping a diary is kind of wanky and sort of narcissistic and... But what I've discovered is that you, when you sort of burrow down far enough into yourself, you get to where everyone else is, and so you're not alone, and you're not just, you know, secretly in a room kind of storing up all your little grievances. You're actually functioning on a level that's common to you and all women and all people, really, when it comes to the crunch.
Did pulling your diary into kind of narrative shape change the narrative you tell yourself about that time?
No, not really, because, I mean, I did have a sense of... Well, the thing about that third book of diaries is it only covers what, 4 years, I think, and it's got a very strong narrative thread because it was basically the marriage was doomed, and I just refused to see it for quite a long time, and I slaved away trying to make it not doomed. But you can just feel it's a downward trajectory, and so yeah, that didn't surprise me. I guess I was most surprised by certain details which I hadn't remembered or hadn't allowed myself to remember.
Yeah, what strikes me are the details you see in the world around you that seem to reflect the sort of pathetic fallacy, the thing inside of you. You write about a sharpened geranium bud, and it's such a violently perfect little image. And it's like the diary, the things that are happening inside of you somehow colour the way in which you're interpreting the world.
Mm. Yeah, one thing I noticed in that diary was how much it rained.
Yeah.
I mean, for those 4 years, I kept coming across these, you know, scores of descriptions of rain.
Well, it's and storm and drung, isn't it, a little bit?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but are diaries scales for a writer, you know? Like,
are they scales?
You say writing a diary is kind of wanky, but I imagine, no, like scales on a piano.
Oh, scales. Yeah. Oh, yeah, very. Yeah, that's how I taught myself to write, was by writing diaries and letters early on when I was younger. But that's a daily practice for me, and I do it first thing in the morning and last thing at night. And I've just spent the last week staying with some friends in Newcastle, and I didn't take the diary. And I mean, I wouldn't take it out of the house. I imagine if I'd lost it. But I didn't write anything down for a week, and I kept thinking, how come I'm just lying here? I mean, it was nice, you know, I was having a really nice time. But when I got home, And I got into my own bed, and then diary was there on the shelf. I thought, oh yeah, I forgot about that. I haven't written anything in it for a week.
What I love about the diaries is your willingness to be self-castigating.
Yeah.
And I asked you in a Zoom conversation we had last year, does artistic self-doubt ever go away? And you're like, hell no, it doesn't. It stays with you forever.
Mm.
And I wonder whether or not we sort of think about it as something that's inevitable that comes with creativity. You know, you're going to feel self-doubt, but I wonder whether or not either of you feel like it's actually necessary. Like, do we need sort of self-doubt, artistic, like that feeling of artistic crumbling, do we need it in order to write, to be good writers?
Yes.
Is it an engine?
Yes, I think so. Do you?
I'd love to have a little bit less of that kind of gnawing feeling going on.
But everybody would love not to do it, but you have to do it.
I'm telling you.
No, but I think in a way it's kind of, you know, I've told this before, and I'll say it again, but I remember once saying to my then husband, I wrote that, and after I wrote that, you know, I really just felt like a little very small piece of shit. And he said, really? And I said, yeah, don't.
Because you should have felt like a really huge piece of shit.
but he said, oh, really? And I said, yeah, don't you feel like that? He said, no, I never feel like that. And I thought, oh, I was shocked because I thought everybody was like me and went around the world thinking they were a little piece of shit. I mean, not all the time, but, you know, that basically that you weren't anything special.
And well, I feel like that most of the time.
You do?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Well, we can be we can be friends.
Yeah, that's right.
No, seriously, I think that it's a self-doubt. It's kind of a sign of good faith in a way. Because what if you didn't doubt what you were doing? What if you were just blurting it out and it's like, take it down to the publisher and they go, oh, yeah, Helen, this is great, we're going to publish it. It's not going to happen. I mean, it's a struggle. And you're fighting yourself a lot of the time, don't you reckon, Chloe?
I would just like to sort of lean into a kind of like some sort of. I mean, I think when you do turn to a story, there's a kind of memory, and you know how to do it, and it kicks in. You turn up at the morgue, Helen, and you know what you're looking for, and that's a lovely feeling. So when you're actually in the process of reporting, I bet you don't feel like.
No.
Such a piece of shit.
No, I don't. When I don't. I feel competent.
Yeah.
And I feel clever. And I think, I am fucking clever.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's when you sit down later to make the book, yeah. you go, oh, actually, I'm really quite thick.
Yeah. yeah.
No, but it's true. When I'm in the court, I used to feel complete calm happiness yeah. Yeah. when I was sitting in a court week after week, just watching a trial roll. And occasionally I would think, I'm completely happy. There's nothing I lack at this moment. I felt that every part of me was working in harmony yeah. with every other part, my mind and my heart and my guts, and that it was all yeah. flowing, and I just loved it. It was so such a wonderful thing.
Mm. When do you feel clever?
Not now necessarily. I totally relate to what Helen's saying, that when that all the senses are sort of working together in concert in the moment of taking in a story.
Yes. It's not at the moment of writing it, but at the moment of when it's been given to you yeah. by the universe.
Yes. Yeah. But I would like to kind of, you know, at the ripe old age of nearly 49, you know, have a little bit more peace in the writing process as well. Mm.
But do you think it's possible?
Well, I don't know. It's an experiment, and we can come back again to the next Writers Festival and sit here and I'll let you know how I go.
One of the things we've talked about, Chloe, is artistic precarity.
Yeah.
And you write about that in your book.
Yeah.
There's a point at which...
What do you mean by precarity?
Oh.
Precariousness?
Precariousness.
Is that the same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. About... There's a point in which Chloe's book, for instance, that there's a potentially life-saving treatment that Don could have.
Yeah.
And it costs more than both of you as writers make in a year, and it's just
in a bad year.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah.
We often talk in abstract about the arts needing funding.
Yeah,
but what does precariousness do to arts, to creativity? What does it do?
Well, it's funny thinking about ambition because you know I think like Helen, I would feel that I'm ambitious for the story, but not necessarily for myself.
Yeah.
So. You know, like what's the sort of small scale element of the story? What's the sort of, you know, what are the bigger political and cultural resonances of the story? But, you know, my other ambition is just to actually survive financially so as to be able to write the next story.
Yeah.
And I think that's really complicated in the sort of gig economy that writers and creative people find themselves in. And... you know, you a room of one's own with a steady and stable income is probably really useful to creativity. You know,
yeah.
So Wolf et cetera have said. So I mean, being on that kind of treadmill of just like sort of you know trying to think through how to fund this is an ongoing pressure.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
I think I told you I got a call from my accountant to tell me that I was officially a failure.
Oh, they said that?
Yeah. That my business was unsuccessful.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah. Well, Ben BJ is, you know, the best, one of the best critics in Australia, and that you're in that situation and it's...
Things are worse now than they were when I was younger, I'm sure. It seemed to me that there were, you know, it was possible for me to think of making a living... I mean, past a certain point, I didn't want to get grants for things, and I never wanted to take advances for books because publishers' advances, because I was always scared that I wouldn't be able to do the book. And I used to think, what if this falls apart? What if those people won't speak to me? What if this happens or that happens? Or what if someone says they'll sue me? And so I used to have, I just used to keep on doing freelance journalism between books or during books. And I was able to do that, but it seems to me that the opportunities aren't there anymore.
Well, also,
but is that because of the internet, perhaps?
Well, I mean, the word rate for those hasn't changed very much in the last 20 years, has it, Helen? Too.
I'm still getting the same as I used to get. Nobody's ever offered to pay me more. I would like to say, and I'm too embarrassed to ask. If there's any editors here, I'm bullshitting. No, seriously, I just that's another thing about ambition. Occasionally, I would find that somebody in the same publication was being paid twice as much as I was.
And you never never asked for that?
No.
See, if anyone's here, please double what Helen gets paid. And the rest of us, please.
No, I'm okay now. You don't have to do it for me. Okay. You have to do it for the ones in her generation who were up against it in a way that worse than we were, I think.
You wrote in your submission to the new sort of cultural review that's being done that time was the thing that arts grants bought you.
Yes.
Time.
Yeah, time to just lie on the bed and read. That's really crucial, isn't it? And just even lie on the bed and think. Or just lie on the bed. because that's, I mean, when do people do their thinking? That's another thing that strikes me about whenever I go out walking, I see everybody's got, you know, they're listening to something. And I think, well, when do they actually think?
Now.
Yeah, I guess.
No.
But, yeah. But, yeah, people need a lot of time. And the sort of time that would give you time to read money, that would give you time to lie on the bed and read Proust, you know, which can take you a year. And otherwise you're not going to do it until you're 90 or something. And you want to read War and Peace or those big, massive books that...
Middlemarch. I've never read Middlemarch.
What?
No. You've never had chicken salt.
I met a woman once... And a couple of these lovely people, a man and a woman in England, and the woman said to me that she refused to marry this guy until he had read Middlemarch.
Really?
So, yeah, so he went away and read Middlemarch and then they got married and they lived happily ever after.
Have you read Middlemarch, Chloe?
I have read Middlemarch.
Okay, fine.
Twice. But I've only read the first volume.
I'll fucking read Middlemarch. Chloe, I'll end with you, because we started with Helen's story and I want to end with yours, is that you've spent, in putting bedtime stories together, immersed in the world of story. And at the beginning I said, we're going to ask the question, what can a story do? What can a story do?
A story can entertain, it can educate, it can console, it can... take us, you know, let us travel and feel our way into other people's lives. Mm. And it can survive. The storytellers might change, but the story goes on. So it's our inheritance.
I think that's a wonderful place to leave today's discussion. Please thank Helen Garner and Chloe Hooper.
Thanks. Thank
you. The wonderful Chloe will be signing books outside. Please go and get your copy of the book I refused to review and then absolutely adored. Helen's diaries are extraordinary. Buy copies for yourself and your friends. They're out in the lobby. Thank you for coming to Melbourne Writers Festival. Thank you for engaging in the world of ideas.
And thank you to BJ Silverhorn.
Yeah, thanks to BJ.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.